This free State of Belief radio podcast is brought to you by Interfaith Alliance, representing 185,000 members across the U.S., drawn from 75 different faith traditions. We're committed to protecting faith and freedom. Find out about the work we do to protect the boundaries between religion and government and unite diverse voices to challenge extremism and build common ground by visiting our website, interfaithalliance.org. Whether you care deeply about minority religious rights, school bullying, LGBT discrimination, the influence of religion on politics, or the influence of politics on religion, Interfaith Alliance is working on initiatives you'll want to support. Learn more and become a member at interfaithalliance.org. From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy. This week we're broadcasting from the Center for American Progress in Washington, D.C., and I need to tell you up front, this is a show like no other we have done.
My name is Tammy Aberg, and up until 3 months ago, my husband Sean and I thought our 15-year-old son, our gay son, Justin Aberg, had the perfect life.
This past September, for the second time, I attended the Federal Partners in Bullying Prevention Summit here in Washington, D.C. At that event, I was fortunate enough to meet Tammy Aberg, a grieving mother who has turned the suicide death of her 15-year-old son, Justin, into a movement for the protection of bullied lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgendered young people. Tammy Aberg will join us on this edition of State of Belief Radio. You do not want to miss this interview.
Why do you pepper spray my words?
According to Occupy Seattle organizers, a priest and a pregnant teenager were also pepper sprayed.
When United Methodist Pastor Rich Lang stood between a line of heavily armed police and emotional Occupy Seattle protesters this past Tuesday in full clerical garb, he may have felt uneasy about the escalated tensions on both sides. What he was not expecting was to be physically attacked by Seattle's finest. Reverend Lang has written a moving essay about his experience that includes a forceful call for organized religion to finally recognize its place on the side of the Occupy movement. You'll meet Pastor Lang just a little bit later on this week's show. But first,
the Occupy Wall Street movement entered its third month Thursday with protests against the economic system in dozens of cities across the country.
Bolstered by what many perceive as an expression of support at the ballot box in the form of pro-labor wins in places like Ohio earlier this month, and galvanized by severe and sometimes violent opposition from police authorities, the Occupy movement continues to grow, not without turbulence, but it continues to grow. Headline-making events last Thursday in New York City and nationwide underscored just how volatile the situation has become. This weekend concludes 4 days declared as Wage Theft Days of Action by Interfaith Worker Justice, along with faith and labor organizations nationwide, aimed to develop a just economic system oriented around just jobs. IWJ has also published an interfaith prayer service for use by Occupy Together communities. And Interfaith Worker Justice Executive Director Kim Bobo joins us now on State of Belief Radio. She's been here before, and we're delighted to have her in this situation. Kim, welcome back.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
How do you see the latest events in the Occupy Together and worker justice movement?
Well, I think that the Occupy movement has done a great service for the nation in putting the issues of inequality and injustice on the national radar. So God bless them. I keep telling my colleagues that, you know, I personally am not all that eager to sleep in a tent on down in a park. But, right, you know, that young people who've always led the nation in terms of social justice issues, that young people in particular have really helped get these issues on the agenda is a great thing. Now, you know, people keep saying, well, the movement doesn't have enough goals and blah, blah, blah. It doesn't have to have all the details worked out to raise up concerns of inequality. And I've been around congregations the last few weeks, and it is helping congregations have serious discussions about, is our economic system working for the majority of people? I mean, that's a valuable conversation for us to have.
It's very valid, both from the standpoint of labor and from the standpoint of religion.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, again, you and I have worked a lot in the religious community over the years, and we know that the immediate response often is around soup kitchens and shelters, right? My own church, we have a soup kitchen, right? I'm a strong believer in soup kitchens and shelters. But we all know that that is not enough.
Mm-hmm.
And that as a nation, we have got to be equipping and addressing the issues of jobs and decent wages so that if you have a job, you can raise your family's dignity. And I believe that this movement is really helping lift up those issues for all of us.
Kim, please tell our listeners, if you will, about Wage Theft Days of Action and what it means, who's involved besides Interfaith Worker Justice.
Wage Theft Days of Action are lifting up the crisis that low-wage workers and middle-income workers are facing in terms of their employers literally not paying them for all their work. We call that wage theft.
Mm-hmm.
It's when, for low-wage workers, one out of four low-wage workers is not paid the minimum wage. Three-fourths of low-wage workers who work overtime actually don't get their overtime hours.
Mm-hmm.
Or 10% of tipped workers have their tips stolen by their employers.
Hmm.
So there's a crisis, in addition to the crisis of not enough jobs and the crisis of inequality, we have a crisis in the country of wage theft. And so we are doing this Wage Theft Days of Action with the Interfaith Worker Justice Network, but also with congregations and with some unions that are fighting wage theft as well. So it's a collective action. What we've seen also is that the Occupy movements, you know, they do these teach-ins around, and they've had various educational events around wage theft at the Occupy movement. Because, again, this is one of the problems in the society that is contributing to the crisis that working families are facing.
Last Thursday morning, I was watching television, the events that were unfolding in New York City, that I wondered as I watched, were those events coordinated with your initiative, or were they more a response to the eviction of Occupy activists from Zuccotti Park?
It was really a response to the eviction. There's just a lot of things going on in the country right now. But frankly, we're all trying to figure out how we support one another.
Right.
And so how do we support the Wage Theft Days of Action? How do we support those who've been occupying? Because, in fact, we're all looking toward the same end, which is a more just society, a more equitable sharing of the resources, and pushing our leaders, our government leaders, our corporate leaders, to really think about what's best for the whole and how do we get these concerns on our national agenda.
A lot of mainstream coverage of the Occupy movement implies, I guess, what we could call a sour grapes position on the part of the protesters, the idea being that they are lazy and jealous of the success of the hardworking 1%. But there's far more to it than that, isn't there? I mean, you've just released an updated edition of your very fine book, Wage Theft in America, Why Millions of Americans Are Not Getting Paid and What We Can Do About It. I know that IWJ's been doing a lot of work around wage theft, and I wish you'd talk a little more about that problem and focus on possible solutions to it.
Well, the good thing about wage theft is there's a lot of things we can do about it. And so what we've seen around the country is that in local communities, people are trying to grapple with this. And they're doing that in a variety of ways. So there are 26 worker centers around the country that are affiliated with IWJ, and these help workers directly. So a worker comes in and she hasn't been paid, and they will first contact the employer, try and find out if there's a mistake or a problem, and then work with her on trying to get those wages back. So we're doing a lot of direct work. But we're also trying to create new structures at the local level. So a year ago, there was an interfaith group in Miami-Dade County that advocated a new law in Dade County to create a structure to help workers who haven't gotten paid. A year later, so just this last week, they released a report that showed that this small little office that's got like one extra staff has helped workers collect $700,000in unpaid wages, right? It's a great, great initiative. Mm-hmm. In Fayetteville, Arkansas, our worker center leaders there worked with the mayor to create a mayoral task force in Fayetteville to figure out how they as a town could do more. Last week, our Austin and Houston worker centers worked with the police departments to figure out how to enforce the theft of services laws that they had passed in the state of Texas. So again, people locally are figuring out how they can do more on this. In addition, congregations are saying, hey, how do we make sure that when we hire a landscape service or we hire a janitorial service, that these services are actually paying workers fairly, right? So there are things we can do as consumers, as congregations, and consumers as individuals to support employers that pay people fairly and not support those who are cheating workers.
Kim Bobo is Executive Director of Interfaith Worker Justice, an organization that's worked for years to raise awareness of the issues that have now brought thousands to occupy together the streets of our nation. She is the author of Wage Theft in America, Why Millions of Americans Are Not Getting Paid and What We Can Do About It, which has just been re-released in a new and updated edition. Listeners, you can keep up to date on the work of Interfaith Worker Justice at www.iwj.org. Having said that, you probably can't keep up with Kim Bobo because we were fortunate to get her in Indianapolis on a mobile phone talking to us. But Kim, we'll take that anytime you can be on State of Belief Radio because you bring such enthusiasm and insight to this whole area. Thank you for being with us again.
Well, God bless you and thank you.
We've got to take a short break now, but coming right up, we're going to be talking to Pastor Rich Lang of University Temple United Methodist Church in Seattle. Now, listen to this. Earlier this week, he was in an Occupy Seattle event, and he was attacked by police despite being in full clerical garb. Later in the show, we'll talk to Tammy Auberg, whose selfless work to oppose bullying grew out of the tragic loss of her 15-year-old son to suicide. I'm Welton Gaddy. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, brought to you by Interfaith Alliance. Welcome back to State of Belief Radio, everyone. I'm Welton Gaddy. I really want you to read something. I want you to read something carefully. State of Belief listener Sarah Robinson forwarded a piece to us this week. It's called A Pastoral Lament. It's written by Reverend Rich Lang, a United Methodist campus minister at the University of Washington. You can read it at www.occupyseattle.org. It's reposted on Daily Coast, and we'll link it also on our website, stateofbelief.com. Pastor Lang's words make blindingly clear the role of organized religion in the Occupy movement, the absolute mandate for faith communities to step forward in support of the protesters, and the truth that there is no more reason to wait for the movement to satisfy mainstream media's demand for a coherent message, the Events of recent weeks have provided that message in abundance. I use the term blindingly, very deliberately. And here to tell us about the event that led to his essay is Pastor Rich Lang. Reverend Lang, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Thanks for having me on.
I really want everybody to read your essay, but I wanted you here to make sure your story got the attention it deserves. Very briefly, what happened on Tuesday in Seattle to you?
While accompanying the a march, a peaceful, nonviolent march, loud but peaceful, through the streets of Seattle, I noticed several opportunities where the police themselves were provoking the marchers by running their bikes into them, by engaging in verbal agitation and so forth. At one point, a very small incident took place in which a police officer on a bike bumped into a girl. The girl went down, and as she went down, her friends tried to pull her away. It was at that point that the police opened up spray peppering the entire crowd. The crowd backed away, obviously, with spray with the pepper spray in the air. And at that point, the separation had been made. The line of police was one area. The marchers were up against a wall in a different area. I walked between the lines. I was alone in full clergy garb, everyone knowing why I'm there, to serve as a buffer and a bridge. And it was at that point that six officers singled me out and began to just soak me, particularly the back of my alb, in pepper spray. And then one officer came up basically put the muzzle right in my face and sprayed pepper spray in my face and blinded. Some kids ran out and grabbed me and pulled me back to the wall.
Goodness.
And so that was the incident that occurred.
Mm. Reverend Lang, coming away from that event, there are a lot of things that I probably would have written. I'm not sure I would have written what you did, but I am very impressed by what you wrote in your essay called A Pastoral Lament. You write, "The Occupy movement is the prophetic word of God calling out to the nation to repent and turn from its ways of corruption." Will you take 1 minute and speak? You're a Christian, I'm a Christian. Speak to Christian people in this nation about what their relationship ought to be, from your perspective, with the Occupy movement.
I think the church should be present with the Occupy movement. You know, the Occupy movement, you can think of it as two ways. There is the idea of the Occupy movement, and there are those encampments. And wherever there is an encampment, I think the church belongs in that encampment and with it, not just clergy, but Christian laity as well. That is the time where we should be building up relationships, where we should be offering aid and comfort and care and the gifts of wisdom and guidance and discernment. The church has so much to offer these primarily young adults, and very many of them very alienated young adults that have not been able to fit into normality,
mm-hmm.
Or the normal culture, and many of them not being able to fit in because they've been pushed out given the economic conditions, the unemployment, et cetera, in our country. The church absolutely belongs as a mission field with the economic refugees of our nation at this point in time.
Reverend,
I think
Richard,
it's a real Kairos moment, time where the Spirit's calling us out to the street.
Reverend Richard Lang is pastor at University Temple United Methodist Church in Washington State. His essay, remember, I want you to read this essay, A Pastoral Lament. His essay is available online, and we'll link to it from stateofbelief.com. Obviously, Reverend Lang, you are articulate, you are an activist, you are compassionate, and you have courage. We admire you and appreciate you taking a few minutes to share your story with all of us and inspire us on State of Belief Radio. Thank you.
Thank you, Alan.
Coming up next, my interview with Tammy Auberg, a grieving mother who has turned the suicide death of her 15-year-old son, Justin, into a movement for the protection of bullied young people. We'll be right back. This is State of Belief Radio, brought to you by Interfaith Alliance. This free State of Belief radio podcast is brought to you by Interfaith Alliance, representing 185,000 members across the U.S., drawn from 75 different faith traditions. We're committed to protecting faith and freedom. Find out about the work we do to protect the boundaries between religion and government and unite diverse voices to challenge extremism and build common ground by visiting our website, interfaithalliance.org. Whether you care deeply about minority religious rights, school bullying, LGBT discrimination, the influence of religion on politics, or the influence of politics on religion, Interfaith Alliance is working on initiatives you'll want to support. Learn more and become a member at interfaithalliance.org. Welcome back to State of Belief Radio, everyone. I'm Welton Gaddy. This past September, I attended the Federal Partners in Bullying Prevention Summit here in Washington, D.C. At that event, I was fortunate enough to meet Tammy Auberg, a grieving mother who has turned the suicide death of her 15-year-old son, Justin, into a movement for the protection of bullied young people. So I am very pleased to welcome her now to State of Belief Radio. Tammy Auberg, thank you so much for being with us today.
Sure, you're welcome. Thank you.
I am not insensitive to the fact that this is hard, but I know that you are speaking out. It's a choice you made. You're organizing people to prevent more instances of the kind of tragedy that your family has endured. And so I want to begin by asking you to talk with us about what happened to your son, Justin. Your son took his life in your own house, isn't that correct?
Yes, in his bedroom.
And you were the one who found him.
Yes, me and my other two sons. Right. Unfortunately, they were with me. After finding him dead the one day, I couldn't imagine him doing that, as he always seemed so happy, and we always thought he had the perfect life. And but about 6 weeks after he died, his friends started telling me that of things that happened to him at school. You know, I spoke with the school board, and the school board pretty much didn't have any type of reaction, really, at all. And didn't say sorry for your loss or anything. And then they found out, more and more what happened to other students in the school district. And they're still in the lawsuit still hasn't been, finished yet, because there's six students who are alive who are trying to get the policies changed right now. But I do remember one of the things that Justin did tell me before, it was about 3 months before he died, is he told me that he came home one day and said that a kid told him he was going to go to hell because he was gay. And I told him, no, God loves everybody. That isn't true. And but then I found out after he died that there are local church groups that had told the kids to go to school and preach the day of truth to all the gay kids. And as far as I've heard from his friends, he was the only one who was out as gay in 8th and 9th grade. So I'm pretty sure he got the brunt of the day of truth. And the counselor not telling me or calling me at all after the friend told her what happened. And the counselor said, thanks for telling me to the friend because he's at the top of my worry list. So I never got told of anything happening to him. I never got told that he was at the top of any worry list. Obviously, they knew more things that were happening to him, or all these things that are being reported but nobody called me to tell me about it. For the staff not to really get involved when, you know, there's the gay bullying going on in the school. Right. You know, I learned about the climate there, about not really addressing the gay bullying because there is a sexual orientation curriculum policy, and it's supposed to stay neutral on things regarding LGBT people. And for kids to, you know, not have teachers do anything or stop them or have anything to say that there are gay people in history, but in that, but only being told that gay people died in like concentration camps or things like that, and then being told that, you know, they're an abomination and everything, that just puts the child or the kid's minds, you know, makes them feel like they're not supposed to exist.
Right, right. Where did you find help? I mean, if the school didn't offer any help, where did you get help?
When I spoke with the school board, there were people in the audience that were from the GET team. It was called the Gay Equity Team. It was parents, teachers, and I think there was some other previous students on there as well that reached out to me and explained to me, you know, that Justin was like, I think he was like the fifth kid in like months to take their lives in the school district. The more I spoke out, the more like students and other parents would come and tell me their stories. And I just, so it's like, it's more, everybody says, oh, it's just one kid, you know, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, you know, even if it was just one, I think that's plenty, but you know, there's so many kids that this is hurting. And so it's like, even though it's really hard and I often, you know, cry and can barely get the words out sometimes, I have to do it because I don't want any other kids to be hurting like this and, or to take their lives.
Tammy, how long did it take you to get there, and how did that happen?
I believe praying to God and having Him give me strength really helped me because it was only 6 weeks after He died for me to start speaking. And, you know, when I had an opportunity to speak with people, I grabbed it whenever I can. I mean, there was a couple of times that I had to cancel when I was just way, way too, you know, sad that day and I just couldn't even leave the house. But, I mean, I'm always sad every day. But, yeah, I believe, you know, and I kept praying to God to give me strength and to help give me peace.
Yeah.
That I could keep doing this. And I really feel that He's been guiding me as opportunities have come to me to speak.
What do you say now to those people who claim that kids should be able to resist being bullied? Though and let's just be honest. I mean, the people that say that involve prominent political figures, leaders in education, so-called religious leaders. How do you respond to that?
It's hard to hear that because, you know, my son was a sensitive person and he was always there and for everybody else. And, you know, he, people, I guess kids would, you know, always come to him with their problems. And so him hearing what they went through and then what he went through, but he didn't really reach out for himself. So, you know, it's like, he's taking on their problems as well as his, but even if he wasn't, you know, he shouldn't have to internalize and to feel so awful about himself that he does something like this. I mean, obviously, if the school isn't doing anything to help them, what option do they think they have? I'm sure he didn't tell me because he knew I would have went to the school, and mm-hmm. he knew what other students were doing, and nothing happened with them. So it's like, if these, you know, these kids feel like there's no way out.
What is this done to the rest of your family? Are you all in the anti-bullying campaign together, or has it hurt some of your family to the point they just can't do that?
My husband and my two other boys have tried to do some things, you know, speaking out here and there,
mm-hmm.
but it's just so hard. And yeah. my husband is very shy, for one. My 9-year-old, he's adopted and he has Asperger's, mm-hmm. but he did speak at a Pacer bullying event this mm-hmm. past fall, and it was a walk against bullying, and he went on stage and told his story and about him being bullied for having Asperger's, and it was just amazing. I'm like, oh my God, he's 9 years old, and he said that. but it's hard because my 19-year-old, he has gotten to the point where he can barely function.
I see.
I don't know. It's just really, really hard for him, and he's just really, really sad, and he has a lot of survival guilt because he feels like, you know, he's the older brother,
mm-hmm.
and he should have known and, you know, protected him, but yeah. you know, he didn't know.
Need more friends with wings. All the angels I now put concrete in my veins. I'd always walk home alone. So
we got to take a break. We've been talking with Tammy Aaberg, whose selfless work to oppose bullying grew out of the tragic loss of her 15-year-old son to suicide. I'm Welton Getty. You're listening to State of Belief Radio. We'll be right back. Welcome back to State of Belief Radio, everyone. I'm Welton Getty. I'm talking to Tammy Aaberg, a grieving mother who has turned the suicide death of her 15-year-old son, Justin, into a movement for the protection of bullied young people. What lessons can you share with parents and others concerned about bullying, especially those who just think it's no big deal?
Well, I want to get out there for parents, you know, whether they think it's a big deal or not, you know, they need to stay and, you know, keep close, you know, contact and check in with their kids to see what's going on, because maybe they don't think it's a big deal, but it is a big deal to the person that this is happening to.
Mm-hmm.
And also to know what's going on in the school with their policies and everything as much as possible. I mean, with Justin, you know, we were pretty close. You know, he would tell me all the good things, and I knew he was gay and everything. And, you know, he was my son no matter how he identified himself. You know, a lot of the times parents contribute to this bullying, especially if their child is, you know, lesbian, gay, bisexual, and so many kids are homeless
mm-hmm.
Because of this. And so to hear all of this, that's what drives me to get out there and to help these kids. And it's so great that there have been so many youth across the country that have told me that I helped give them inspiration mm-hmm. and the empowerment to go out there and speak themselves, and for the youth to go out there and tell their stories and explain how it makes them feel. I think people listen a lot more to them.
Right.
And to get out there, you know, lobby your congress people, federal and local, check the policies in your state.
Mm-hmm.
There's so many people out there, especially the Tea Party people,
yeah.
That well, you know, think it's not a big deal, and they don't want the government to be involved anymore in our schools. It's like, you know, this has nothing to do with actual curriculum. You know, it's this is a safety of our kids. Kids are dying.
Right. Tammy, I thought of you the other day reading about legal developments in Michigan with their efforts at anti-bullying legislation, but giving a religious exemption. Because I remember you saying, and you've said it today, that religious bullying was a part of what was going on in Justin's life, being told he was going to hell, devaluing his personality from people doing that in the name of religion. Yet religion has been a part of your recovery and the strength for you to do what you're doing. I'm curious if you were speaking to a group of religious leaders about bullying, what would you say to them?
Well, it doesn't matter, you know, beliefs of different religions. You know, people are people. I mean, if you don't believe in the other person's religion, where they came from, if they're LGBT, you know, questioning youth if they're gay, you know,
mm-hmm.
You don't have to believe in anything to have somebody treated correctly. We are all the same people. We all bleed. We all, you know, have feelings and hurts, and, you know, we all live together, and I think we should all live together peacefully. And for me, religious leaders should show an example of how to treat people with love and respect, mm-hmm. And not be out there in public and using God's name for hate.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's just awful. God does not hate anybody.
Tammy Aaberg is a brave, inspiring woman who has channeled the pain of losing her 15-year-old son, Justin, to suicide after years of relentless bullying into working to end bullying of other young people. A part of her work is the website Justin's Gift, A Safe Place for Youth. You can go there at www.justinsgift.org. Tammy, it's a beautiful website with a beautiful message. I want to quote from it. Shortly after his death, his family and friends made it their mission to tell Justin's story and to make sure that other young gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender, or questioning students would no longer have to go through the hardships Justin faced. It's now their mission to let students know that there is help available and that every person is born with gifts that need to be shared. Tammy Aaberg, I thank you so much for sharing your story, your work with us today, and ways in which we can eradicate this evil called bullying from our nation. Thank you for being with us on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you.
Take care of yourself.
You too.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's State of Belief. I know today's show has been an emotional roller coaster. I feel it. I'm sure you do too. But I hope you'll join us again next week when we'll be celebrating Thanksgiving with highlights from last week's gala celebration of this year's Walter Cronkite Faith and Freedom Awards
given by Interfaith Alliance. You'll hear from three people we're particularly thankful for, Right Reverend Bishop Jane Holmes Dixon and legendary PBS newscaster Jim Lehrer, as well as President's Award recipient singer Shelley Wright. You'll also hear a special message on gratitude from Rabbi Irwin Kula, who is a past recipient of the Walter Cronkite Faith and Freedom Award. In the meantime, please visit us online at stateofbelief.com to find out more about the show, to hear extended interviews, read transcripts, sign up for our podcasts. You can learn about the new State of Belief app for iPhone and Android devices. Share your thoughts on what you've heard on Facebook and Twitter. Look, this is what we want, a conversation. Contact information is available at stateofbelief.com, including the listener line 202-238-3291. And while you're talking about all of the issues we talk about on State of Belief Radio, remember it's a production of Interfaith Alliance. You can become a member today of Interfaith Alliance at interfaithalliance.org. We'd love to have you in the membership. And join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.